You're listening to live courtroom coverage of the trial of Lori Vallow Daybell from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Now, back to the courtroom.
When would you give CPR to a person?
If they don't have a pulse. You confirm that just by checking for a pulse, and you don't feel that. The heart isn't beating, and you would need to start chest compressions.
What is the point of that, of doing those chest compressions? You said moving the blood through the body. Why?
You're trying to, you know, give them a chance, increase their chance of survival. I don't know what maybe the latest numbers and statistics might say, but in the past I've seen it say that if somebody's starts CPR within the first few minutes, it can double or triple their chances of surviving.
When you are called to a scene, are you guys being given updates by the 911 operator to your dispatch so you know what to expect?
Yeah, so you get dispatched and you already have an idea of the type of call, and then in route we call it PTI, and that will come across the computer screen. And so now you have more information of what you're kind of walking into, so you can kind of game plan it a little bit more.
If somebody calls 911 and doesn't know how to do CPR, what happens?
My understanding is that 911 would talk them through that and give them instructions of what to do.
Okay. When you are giving CPR, you talked about chest compressions. Can you talk to us about, is there any physical identification that you might observe on a person who has had CPR, chest compressions?
That I might see?
After a person has been given chest compressions.
Yes. You need to perform it in the right location. So it's the lower half of the sternum or breastbone. To kind of find that, it's more helpful if you can see the skin, maybe lift up the shirt. So that's typically something we're going to want to do. If CPR has been done and it's been done effectively enough, you can see almost like a depression or an impression that is left there on the skin. Because you need to do it forceful enough and deep enough that you're actually compressing the heart to push the blood.
So you said you might see a depression. Does that not just pop right back out when you stop?
No, you'll still see it. You'll see it like if you stop CPR during the call for whatever reason that it might be appropriate, and then you go back to resuming CPR, you'll see where your hands were. That area can be vulnerable to breaking. Ribs can break during CPR, so there's typically depression in the chest.
Do you ever actually hear anything when you are giving someone chest compressions?
I for sure feel it. I don't know if it's audible enough to hear it, especially with maybe the rest of the commotion that's going on, but you definitely feel that crunch or that crack. I kind of compare it to like if you're cracking your knuckles in your hands or something, your fingers. It kind of feels like something like that, but more extreme, I guess.
And this is something that you have felt multiple times in doing CPR?
Yes, in teaching CPR, you want to forewarn people of that too, that to kind of expect that and not necessarily kind of be alarmed. You don't want them to think they've caused more harm necessarily.
Does that crack or crunch occur each time you restart CPR in the same patient?
No, it's typically just the first couple of times.
Have you previously performed CPR on a person who was shot?
I'm sure I probably have.
When you are performing CPR on a person that's shot, have you ever seen that cause more blood to come out if there are gunshot wounds?
Yes. I've been on some scenes where, you know, it's been a little more bloody, so to speak. You have to be cautious of where you're stepping, or if you're kneeling down by the patient's side to perform the CPR, you're trying to be careful of that.
I want to bring you to July 11th of 2019, a call to 5531 South Four Peaks Place. Do you recall this incident?
Yes.
Do you still have some independent memory of this?
Yes.
Was it the fact that the police interviewed you also make this a more memorable scene?
Yes.
Do you recall when you first got to the scene, did you just drive right up, or how did you guys approach the scene?
Call types like this, we're going to stage and wait for PD to clear the scene so it's safe to enter. So you're going to get into in this particular case, you're going to be in the neighborhood, but you're going to be around the corner, around the block, a street away, whatever kind of might make the most sense based on where we're coming from.
Okay. How many people are on a fire engine?
In the city of Chandler, we typically have at least four on any of our fire engines and fire ladders.
And what was your role?
So you'll have a captain who's up front. That's the person that's in charge. I'm a fire engineer specifically, so I drive the fire apparatus. And then we'll have two firefighters in the back seat.
Do you recall in this case about how far away you were staged?
I mean, from a time standpoint, we might have been 30 seconds away.
Who were the other people on your team that day?
By names?
If you recall.
Okay. Captain Keller, firefighters Kaczynski, and firefighter Fife.
When you arrive at a scene like this, you told us that there's a captain, you're the driver. Does everyone sort of have a job, or how does that work when you first get there?
You typically may kind of talk about roles and what might happen. Also, like in this particular case, this was our first call of the day. So all of our calls, we're going to do some documentation and chart it. And so we typically start with the captain will start the first call of the day. So that meant Captain Keller was going to be charting it. So that would lead the other three of us to do the evaluation, assessment, and patient contact and skills.
So when you drove up to the scene, what did you see?
I remember us having to make a turn, and a couple of officers, I feel like, were already there, kind of navigate their cars, position right in front of the house. Saw at least one officer outside, saw a citizen, I feel like, probably in the driveway somewhere with that officer. And then we just kind of proceeded out of the apparatus.
When you guys entered the house, you said that Captain Keller was going to be charting. So does that mean he wouldn't be touching the patient?
More than likely not, unless we needed additional help. I mean, he possibly could have been the first one in. Also, the way we were parked, that passenger side of the fire apparatus was the closest to the front door. He might have been in first, because I'm going to be on the other side. The two firefighters are getting out and going to the back compartment of the truck to get the equipment. So he may have walked up and possibly checked a pulse or something like that first, but he didn't. I don't feel like he did anything else other than that, if that.
Okay. You told us that as you're going there, you're receiving information about the patient, correct?
Correct.
In this case, had you received any information about whether or not he was receiving CPR?
Yes, I recall we had that info two ways. We had it with the PTI on our computer screen, which would be coming from our fire department dispatch. And then we have the ability to also listen on the radio to the PD channels. And so we can hear communication between the officers that are getting on scene and then the PD dispatch. And they also communicated that at some point in time.
When you entered the house, was there an officer already inside?
I believe there was an officer inside with Captain Keller.
And did you observe anyone giving the patient CPR?
No.
Can you tell us what you saw when you first entered the house?
You walked in the front door, just kind of a little entryway, and it kind of, I feel like it stepped down into maybe a formal kind of family room or something, but it was empty with no furniture anywhere in the room. That jumped out at first because it makes it easier. Like sometimes we're on scenes where a patient could be between a bed and a closet and you got to move them somewhere. So those thoughts are already kind of in your mind that you may have to move a patient just to have better access, and that was not a challenge here.
Did you notice any blood on the scene?
Not until I saw it on the patient's chest, but I didn't see it in the room. It wasn't something that I was going to need to avoid kneeling in to do CPR, avoid standing in, walking around. There's four of us. We probably had at least four boxes of equipment in there, so we didn't have to worry about where we placed this stuff in terms of blood.
Have you been to scenes where there's a large pool of blood around the patient that you're trying to not step in, kneel in, get in?
Yes.
You told us that you saw blood on the patient. Do you recall seeing any blood pooling in his chest, neck area?
I don't recall it pooling. He still had clothes on, a shirt on, and so it had been absorbing some blood.
I'm going to show you an admitted. Exhibit number 3. Do you recall ever seeing this pooling of blood around his neck there?
I don't recall that.
Okay. When you first saw the patient, what was your first impression?
That he's lying there unresponsive. You're not seeing any signs of life. You don't see somebody that's maybe moaning from an injury, moving, no spontaneous breathing. What was your question again?
Just your first impressions of him as you are walking in and you're looking at him and assessing him.
Yeah. I guess that would be sufficient for my answer.
Did you think that he could be deceased?
It's definitely was a possibility. There was no, like I said, no obvious signs of life.
When you got into the room, did someone begin performing CPR on him?
So when I got to Charles' side, I would have performed a more detailed assessment, so to speak, rather than what I was seeing visually. So you're checking for responsiveness. You can move the patient. You're going to check for a pulse. Now you're closer to the chest. You're looking for breathing, seeing if you see the chest rise and fall. And we would call him unresponsive and pulseless and apneic. Apneic meaning not breathing. And then I would have started CPR.
So he wasn't breathing. He had no pulse. He wasn't moving. There were no signs of life.
Correct.
You told us that you had received information that someone had been doing CPR prior to your arrival, correct?
Correct.
Did that impact your view of the patient and your decision making on what you should do next when you see this patient that is lifeless?
I mean, it makes you think that there's a increased likelihood that of survival, possibly, until we can, you know, starting CPR is still appropriate to do, and then we can utilize some of our rest of our equipment. We can put an EKG machine on. We can actually see what the heart is doing. We can look at the rhythm. we wouldn't want to call a patient before, like, taking some additional steps.
Okay. Who performed CPR?
I did.
And I put up Exhibit 4 here. Do you recognize who these people are?
Yes.
And who are they?
So standing to the left is Captain Keller. He's documenting. Standing to the right is Firefighter Kaczynski. And then kneeling down back towards us is myself. And then kneeling down where you're pointing is Firefighter Fife.
When you first began performing CPR, can you tell us what you felt?
So at first I didn't see a depression that would typically be left from somebody else previously doing compressions. So I thought that was odd considering the information we had en route. I started doing compressions. I felt that initial crack and crunch for probably the first couple of compressions that, again, you would typically feel when you're first starting compressions and if you're going hard enough and deep enough.
How long did you do CPR before you evaluated and utilized any other means to see if he might still be alive, savable?
If I had to estimate, I think I was probably doing CPR, chest compressions, for at least a minute. It probably took them at least 30 seconds to a minute to maybe get in to the house where I was after I entered. They've got to set down that equipment and get some of that out. So I feel like at least a minute is a fair assessment.
What happened next? Is there some way to check his heart to see if there's activity, or what do you do?
Yes, so I was doing chest compressions. I remember mentioning, because there's bullet holes going through them, so I remember mentioning to Firefighter Kaczynski when she went to cut the shirt to not cut through a bullet hole. So she kind of went along the side. That's exposing the chest, so that way then we can put our heart monitor and perform an EKG on Charles to kind of see what his rhythm is doing. A person can typically still do chest compressions while they're doing that, and they can kind of work around you. But at some point in time, you're going to have to stop. That way, you can just look at what the machine is showing you and telling you.
Was there any heart activity when you put on those EKG?
No, it was what we would call asystole, and it's just a flat line on the screen. There's no electrical activity of the heart.
At some point, you said you saw gunshot wounds. Do you recall how many you saw in the front there?
I saw two.
Do you ever look to see if there's exit wounds?
We did roll him. I seem to recall and remember that we rolled him my way. I feel like the other two firefighters were then on that other side. Firefighter Kaczynski, who's the one that is standing up, I feel like she had a better view of what those looked like since he was rolled my way. But I remember her commenting that there was two wounds on that backside of the patient.
So when you say he was rolled towards you, he's rolled towards this mirror over here?
Correct.
Okay. When you had stopped doing the CPR to roll him and he goes back, did you notice the depression in his chest now?
After I resume CPR, yes. It makes it kind of easier to find your landmark, so it's something that you typically look for.
So it was not there when you first started CPR?
Correct.
But it was after you had performed it?
Correct.
Do you wear gloves when you do this?
Yes.
Did you have blood on your gloves after you were doing CPR?
Yes.
You told us that when you first arrived, there was not much concern for having to navigate around blood that might be pooling around the victim, correct?
Correct.
After you had been doing CPR, was there more blood now around the patient?
There was definitely more on his chest. More was coming out of the wounds, specifically the one on the chest, from what I recall. The shirt isn't necessarily there to absorb it anymore. We've removed it. I can't recall necessarily on the ground, like where I might have been kneeling, but.
When you first arrived, did you see any blood exiting the abdomen wound?
I did not.
As you were at this scene, you guys did the EKG. There was no heart activity. What do you do after that?
At some point in time, we just kind of have to look at patient viability, and we're just looking at the facts and how he's kind of presenting, and we're considering time that we've already been on scene, time, staging, responding, all of that, and we ultimately we do have offlines that we follow for different types of medical calls, and we felt that he fell into that category of not being viable and that we could call him on scene.
Now, you talked about you were not staged very far away, correct?
Correct.
Were you staged very long before you pulled up?
I felt like we might have been there for at least a couple of minutes.
Okay. When the patient was rolled, did anyone notice anything about, or did you notice anything about his skin that made you also question perhaps how long it had been since he had been shot?
Yes, it was pointed out because I didn't have a good view of that backside, the skin color, some modeling. There's changes in the skin color that are starting to occur from, you know, blood hasn't been circulating, hasn't been circulating as effectively as compared to when the heart is beating. You've got two injuries to the thoracic torso of the body, so to speak, the chest and abdomen. Those are going to hit internal organs and cause internal bleeding. And so that blood is starting to kind of what we would call dependent lividity, and it's just gravity. It's just kind of starting to go towards the backside, and the color changes are occurring.
So as the heart stops, the blood starts to just pool.
Yes, it's just stagnant and not being moved, and then those injuries inside, he's going to be bleeding internally.
And so some of that pooling causes color changes to the skin?
Yes.
That were observed?
Yes.
Was there anything about this victim, about Charles, that made you think that CPR may not have been performed on him prior to you arriving?
It was just simply the fact that what I saw on the chest when I first looked at it before I started CPR, and then what I felt during my first couple of chest compressions.
After you guys rolled him, saw the modeling and the lividity, was any further CPR performed?
From what I recall, yes.
Okay. When did you call this then?
Say that again.
When did you call it? When did you stop performing CPR?
So I don't remember with 100% certainty if I feel like, from what I recall, I'm performing chest compressions, the shirt's going to be cut off, we're exposing the patient, rolling, looking for more wounds and injuries, confirming what we see on the back, pointing that out to Captain Keller so he can document it, rolling back down, resuming CPR, monitors going on, stopping again to look at what the monitor's saying, resuming again to then have a brief discussion based on, okay, what we found, what are we thinking, where does he kind of fall?
ultimately, did you guys terminate any treatment at about 8:48 a.m.?
If that's what's on the documentation, I would agree with that. I know we responded in the morning. It was our first, our shift starts at 8 a.m. This was our first call. I don't remember if you said earlier what time we were dispatched or not, or just established the date.
If my paralegal could approach with the charting, would looking at the charting help you refresh your recollection as to when you guys ended
sure.
any life-saving means?
So it looks like our dispatch is 8:37. Looks like we might have made patient contact at 8:45. The dispatch screen that will have like times of responding and things like that would might have an appropriate time on it also that I'm not seeing right here though, but I'm still looking. So I see our first monitored rhythm as the ACISTE, like I said, that date time, I see a time of 8:48. So that might have been when we called him. I can see the obvious signs of death that Captain Keller used as the reason for discontinuing ROSC, return of spontaneous circulation, though. So that would probably be the appropriate time.
Okay. After, does it seem about right that you were with this patient for maybe 3 or so minutes? Working, actively working.
Actively working, I think, probably close to 5 minutes.
And once he's called, do you guys, what do you do at the scene? What do you do with all your equipment?
So once he's called, it's kind of a PD scene now. So we're going to, you know, we're going to leave the body. We're going to gather up what we can, our equipment. Sometimes there's some stuff we might need to leave behind that's necessary to leave on the patient, but
so like the EKG monitors that are stuck on him, you leave those on him?
Yeah, we can disconnect those exactly and bring the cables with us.
Okay. When you told us when you arrived that you noticed a individual with a police officer near the driveway.
Correct.
Did you see that same person still outside when you exited?
Yes.
Did you notice any bleeding or obvious injuries to that person?
No.
Did you make an assumption as to who that was?
Yes, our PTI en route said brother or brother-in-law shot brother, so performing CPR, so you're kind of assuming it's that person.
Okay. In terms of his size, is he someone that you talked about people may not be able to always be strong enough or able to perform CPR in a way to cause the depression or that crunching sound, for lack of a better term? In your experience, what type of people are we talking about for that, where you wouldn't be surprised that you may not have seen that depression or the crunching?
It's typically going to be maybe an elderly population, somebody that's not as big, not as strong, that might not be able to perform chest compressions hard enough and deep enough. Sometimes if a patient is in a bed, so mattress has give to it, compressions won't be as effective. You want to get them to the floor. Obviously, he was already on the floor, so that aids chest compressions.
Was there anything about this male that you saw when you observed him entering or exiting that made you believe that he had been injured?
No.
based upon your training and experience and what you observed and did in this case, would you agree that the victim, Charles Vallow, was dead before you entered the house?
Yes.
Based upon your training and experience and what you observed and did in this case, would you agree that it was highly unlikely that anyone had performed CPR on Charles Vallow prior to you doing that?
Yes.
I have no other questions, Your Honor.
All right. Cross.
You want me to go now? Or it's 4:30. I didn't know if you wanted to.
How long do you anticipate your cross-examination?
It'd take a while, Your Honor.
All right. We'll break for the evening then. We'll need you back here tomorrow morning at 10:30.
10:30?
Yes. All right. We'll release the jury at this time for the evening. We'll resume tomorrow at 10:30 a.m. Please remember the admonition.
All rise for the jury.
All right, you can be seated. You can step down if you want. Is there anything we need to discuss before recessing for the evening from the state?
No, Your Honor.
From the defense? Is there anything we need to discuss before we recess?
No, Your Honor.
All right, we'll see you tomorrow at 10:30.
There's more live courtroom coverage coming up. Press subscribe now so you don't miss a second. From the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today.